variations, none of them pleasant. Some have claws, others fangs. Although my time, while changed by the potion, is like a dream, all fuzzy around the edges. One of the other men told me I was a wolf, but 10 times the size. They said I tried to escape my cage, but the bars held. Samet paused for that to sink in, before continuing. The other thing I remember is the anger coursing through me. The bloodlust. It was like a monster had taken over my body, my mind. I hated it. Hated it. Losing control is my worst nightmare. But the other soldiers who were a part of the experiment felt differently. They enjoyed it. They spoke of how they couldn't wait to drink more of the potion, feel that power again. Anise glanced at Terin, but even under the glow of several torches, his eyes were cast in shadow. She wondered whether he felt the same way Metz had, only all the time. She wished there was something she could say to comfort him. His head turned towards hers for a moment, but then shifted away. "How do we defeat them?" Anise asked, turning her attention back to Metz. "By focusing," he said. "One monster at a time. Every soldier fighting one." Dietrich spoke. "But won't the other monsters obliterate us while we're doing that? It will be another massacre." "I don't think so," Metz said. "But you're not certain." "Of course not. Certainty is a fool's game." "Now, hold on just a moment. Are you calling me a—" Anise raised her hand for silence. "Sir Dietrich, let him finish." He closed his mouth, but didn't look too happy. "I meant no offence, sir," Metz said politely. "Only that no one, at least until today, has ever fought creatures like these. They're unnatural, potion-created. We can't be certain of anything. But I did see the way they reacted to each other in their cages. They looked like they hated each other as much as the rest of us. Before I was made to drink the potion, I saw 4 others drink first. They tried to attack each other through the bars. So if we concentrate on one monster, it may only draw the other monsters to fight each other." "That could just give us a chance," Anise said, nodding. "This is good information. Thank you, Sir Metz." "I am only doing my duty," he replied stiffly, bowing.
"How will we coordinate our attack across our forces?" Terin asked.
Anise was glad he'd finally spoken. She said, "Sir Dietrich will issue the commands. I will rely on the other commanders to spread the word. But as soon as the attack begins, it should be obvious which monster we're focusing on first." "And if I die?" Dietrich asked.
"Good question,"
Zelda offered enthusiastically from the back, holding up a drumstick.
"You won't," Anise said firmly.
The strength of her response seemed to surprise the knight, and he nodded.
"But if you do, the chain of command shall continue down the line. Most of all, we need to rely on our trained officers to ensure our untrained soldiers don't retreat at the first sign of violence."
"Agreed," Dietrich said.
"Did you really call it an ugly stone mutt, and shout for it to face the bear slayer?" Terin asked, his dark lips curling at the corners in amusement.
As Terin had requested, they were in a tent large enough for even him to stretch out across. His head was at one end and his feet at the other, brushing the sides. Again, he looked larger than before, like he had grown taller and broader in only a day. As Anise had requested, his armor lay in one of the corners, leaving his translucent, black-veined skin bare, save for a thin pair of trousers tied with a rope around his waist. She was having trouble not gawking at the way his broad shoulders met his muscular chest, met his brick wall-like abdomen, as if he was wearing another set of armor, this one made to look like skin. The dark, protruding veins were like ropes, tying everything together.
"I do not recall," Anise said.
"Liar."
Terin grabbed her and pulled her into his lap, curling a strong hand behind her neck while kissing her deeply. She pulled away sharply, as images assaulted her mind. A man being ripped in half. A soldier smashing into a tree. Humans crushed, blood spilt, bones broken.
Her people. Her army.
What is it?
Terryn asked, concern unravelling across his face.
I don't know if I can do this now.
The words burned in her throat, because she did want to do this, more than anything, more than being a queen and fighting to take back what was rightfully hers. More than anything, she just wanted to love this man the way he deserved to be loved. Terryn nodded, pulling her into a hug. He was so warm, so safe. Why couldn't she stay like this forever, and forget queens and kings, empires and kingdoms, unconscious brothers and evil uncles? But she knew her dream of fleeing to the hinterlands vanished into mist the moment she became queen. As if reading her mind, Terryn whispered into her ear,
"You are the queen now, and their pain is your pain. Their sorrow is your sorrow. Their deaths are your grief. I cannot begin to understand how hard today was for you."
Anise shook her head, her cheek rubbing against his broad shoulder. How did he know? How did he sense what she was feeling well enough to put into words what she was unable to herself?
How are you real?
She was also having trouble reconciling the two Terryns she knew. The first Terryn, the one who'd fought the monster, unleashing violence like an uncaged beast, who'd stalked into the woods dripping blood, seemed like a stranger sometimes. Even after he'd returned, he hadn't spoken to her for a long time, going about helping the wounded, setting up camp, collecting firewood, scouting the area for any evidence of other creatures. Then, slowly, little by little, that Terryn had given way to this one, with his quick-witted quips and broad smile and endless chivalry. It was like the two versions of him were fighting for control. Sometimes she feared who would emerge victorious. What scared her more, however, was that Terryn seemed to fear the very same thing.
"You know," he continued when she didn't respond, "I could have died today. You as well."
Anise frowned. Was he falling back into his hole of despair? His dark, twinkling eyes said otherwise.
"I am very much aware of the danger we were in. Is there a point to this topic?"
"Yes," Terryn said,
pulling her face toward his once more. His other hand dropped to her hip, resting there gently, rubbing circles with his thumb.
"My point is that we should not waste the precious time that we have. Not one moment of it."
And then he kissed her again, and this time she gave herself to it fully, her nightmares chased away as he pulled off her clothes. 21. The Western Kingdom, the Crimean Sea, somewhere west of the Dead Isles. Grey Aris.
"What did you do to her?"
Grey demanded, his eyes boring into Captain Smithers. The captain laughed, and the sound made Grey's blood boil in his veins. How could he laugh when his own daughter was bleeding on the floor?
"I see you've taken a liking to me daughter, have you? Get in line, boy. E and ever the lad tween Night's End and Talis. Me daughter is a self-admitted whore child, don't ye get that? Damaged goods. I didn't lay a finger on her. No, I didn't have to. Wrath is only making her pay for her sins. She's lucky God didn't deliver her to the Furies. Now git! She needs time to think about what she's done."
Behind him, Kyla's moans had turned into choking sobs. Grey was seething, every muscle in his body pulled tight like a bowstring ready to release its arrow. He knew what had happened. What could he do? A captain was the king of his ship. If he challenged the captain's authority now, he could be hanged for treason, or thrown overboard. Shay would have no one left to save her. So he took a deep breath, uncurled his fisted fingers, and turned around, leaving Kyla bleeding on the floor behind her father. And as he walked away, Grey hated himself more than he ever had before. Grey took a dozen steps before he turned around. The captain was watching him with narrowed eyes.
"You got something to say, boy?"
"Aye," Grey said. If you won't help her, let me. And then I'll never talk to her again, I swear it. The captain blinked rapidly, like there was something in his eyes.
Why would ye help her?
He asked. The question took Gray by surprise. He'd expected nothing less than an outright rejection. Because I can, he said. Smithers' body stiffened. A few moments passed in silence, and then his shoulders slumped. His eyes closed, opened. His mouth opened, closed, opened again. He said,
Fine. Do as you will, but don't let your work suffer.
He stomped off, his boots disappearing up the steps to the top deck. Gray blinked. Did that really just happen? He'd seen something in the captain's eyes before he'd left, something he'd never seen before. Grief? Perhaps, but not only. Regret. Yes, that was there too, but the one thing he thought he saw the most was something else. Guilt. Gray approached the doorway, which was still open. Kyla's moaning had grown softer, no more than the aching cry of a dying animal. Except Gray didn't think she was dying. No, she was mourning. He peeked around the corner. If she was aware of his confrontation with her father or his presence, she gave no indication. She was completely and utterly focused on her arms, which held something in a bundle of bloody rags. The something wasn't moving, wasn't making a sound. Quiet and still. Kyla, Gray said, are you hurt? Her lips pursed together, clamping off the sound. Her voice was a shattered glass whisper.
It only matters. Because it hurts.
Gray took a step forward into something wet. Kyla's blood, sticky, the smell of copper coins flooding his nose. Kyla's head turned toward him. Her brow was sweaty, tendrils of hair sticking to her smooth, brown skin.
Do you want to see my beautiful girl?
She asked.
A girl. Oh, Roth. If you exist, fix this. Give her back her child. I don't know,
Gray admitted. The thought of seeing a dead baby made bile creep up his throat.
Father wouldn't even look at her. His own granddaughter,
Kyla said, tears dripping from her chin. Gray steeled himself.
Let me see, he said.
He stepped closer, ignoring the blood. Crouching down, he peered at the bundle as Kyla unwrapped it. For a moment he thought he was looking at a doll. Her face was so tiny, her eyes pinched shut, her nose naught but the size of a button, her little lips thin on top and fuller at the bottom. Just like Kyla's. Her face had been wiped clean, and her skin was a lighter shade of brown than her mother's, her chin narrower, her eyes closer together. She had a full head of hair, brown and matted with blood and birthing fluid. He almost couldn't believe the truth behind his next word.
Beautiful. So beautiful.
And it was true. Even in death, this child, this baby, was the most beautiful thing in the world.
Do you think so?
Kyla's lips trembled. Her eyes filled with an ocean of tears.
Yes,
Gray breathed. He didn't think about what he did next, wrapping her in his arms, ignorant to the blood soaking his trousers, the tears drenching his shirt. Ignorant to everything but the broken girl and her lifeless daughter they held together. As one, their shoulders shook. The other seamen and their captain stayed above decks long into the night. For once, they made no bawdy jokes, nor sang rowdy drinking songs. For once, their cruel laughter ceased. Gray wondered whether the captain had finally put an end to it, or whether it was only a temporary reprieve. For an hour, Gray helped Kyla clean herself, running up and down the steps, tossing buckets of bloody water into the ocean and then refilling them using the hand crank. He knew the blood might attract large predators, but so long as no one got thrown overboard, it wouldn't be a problem. He was aware of the men's eyes following him each time he emerged and raced to the railing, but he ignored them. They didn't matter, not now. Perhaps they never did. The captain, on the other hand, didn't look once, his back to Gray, his gaze trained firmly out to sea. Back below decks, Gray used a damp cloth to clean Kyla's feet, her knees, her legs. He turned away so she could clean the rest of herself. He cleaned her baby while Kyla changed clothes, and then he handed her back the child and took her blooded frock above and tossed it into the ocean. Once she'd been settled into bed with extra pillows he'd stolen from the seamen's bunks, Gray found a thick, clean towel and handed it to her. She looked at it, confused. "To catch any more blood," he explained. He tried not to blush, but failed miserably. She shook her head, biting her lip.
"Thank you," she said.
He got to work on the floor, scrubbing tirelessly, determined to return the wood to its natural color. His right arm felt strong, his muscles tight from all the hard work over the last few weeks. While Kyla held her baby and watched, Grace scrubbed the bloodstains away until they might have never existed. Finished, he rose and went to her side. He held her hand. He stroked her brow. Her face wore a frown.
"You don't care that I'm a whore?" she asked.
Gray grimaced, hating the way she used that word so casually to refer to herself, because she'd heard it so much.
"I don't know what you are, but you're not what the world thinks you are." "You are a good man," Kyla said, and kissed the back of his hand.
Gray had the urge to tell her the truth, how wrong she was, but instead he said,
"You should sleep. Let me take her." "No," she said. "She stays with me."
Gray nodded, closing the door on his way out. Above, the stars pierced the black sky like sparkling yellow coins interlaced with rubies and emeralds. He looked for the golden key amongst them, but it was gone, vanished, like the tiny soul that should have been Kyla's daughter. Gray stripped down to his underclothes and got to work scrubbing out the blood from his clothes. All the men had slept without their pillows and hadn't once complained. Without speaking, they went about their daily tasks. Gray immediately noticed the mainsail was hung at half-mast, not even catching the wind. The captain apparently hadn't slept at all, and when Gray made his way to the bow, Smithers was still standing there, staring out at perhaps something only he could see. He didn't flinch when Gray spoke, as if he was expecting him. "If it's what you want, I won't speak to Kyla again," Gray said. The man didn't respond with words, but his shoulders shook and his hand went to his face as he cried. Gray left him to his grief and regret and guilt, and went to see Kyla. To Gray's surprise, when he knocked, the door flew open. Kyla threw herself into his arms, clutching him so tightly he thought it might crack one of his ribs.
"I didn't think you'd ever speak to me again," she said in his ear.
"Because of your father?" Gray asked, holding her at arm's length, scanning the room over her shoulder. The bed was made, the extra pillows gone. In the center of the bed was a small bump, wrapped in a clean white sheet.
"No, because I'm not your problem."
A pang of sadness thumped in Gray's chest. The truth was, he'd almost walked away from her last night, when she'd needed him the most.
"I didn't,"
Gray reminded himself. For once, perhaps, he'd made the right choice.
"You're not anyone's problem," Gray said. "You're a person. You're my friend."
He didn't intend to make her cry again, but she did, pressing her cheek against his chest. He waited for her to say something, but she didn't, and they stood that way for a long time. Finally, she pulled away and spoke.
"Do you think if I said something to my daughter, that she would hear me?"
Gray's eyes instinctively flitted to the wrapped form on the bed.
"No," Kyla said. "Not her. Not her body. Her soul."
Gray didn't know what he believed, not anymore. A month ago he would have said this life was all they had, and Kyla's daughter was dead for good. Just like his parents. Just like Kyla's mother. But now, even if he didn't believe, he wanted to believe.
"Yes," he said, and though it wasn't the truth exactly, it wasn't a lie either.
Kyla smiled, nodding.
"I think so, too," she said. "Will you listen?"
"Of course."
They sat on the bed, side by side, almost touching, but not quite, except for their hands, which were clasped together like two parts of the same being.
"You will always be known to me as Myrie," Kyla said. "My Myrie."
Her voice broke, but she blinked rapidly and swallowed, fighting off the emotion.
"I want you to know that life wasn't always like this. So sad, so broken. I want you to know that once I used to awaken to the smell of yeasty bread rising, the sound of your grandmother singing, the glow of sun on the windowsill. I want you to know that once I was happy, and that I always believed you could make me happy again. Life was once better, and I never gave up hope that it could be once more. You gave me that hope."
"Can it be better?"
The question fell off of Gray's lips like a pebble bouncing off a cliff, breaking and clattering until it disappeared. Kyla's eyes snapped to his. They were deep pools of brown, and he felt there was something mysterious in them, hidden so deep it could never be reached.
"I know who my daughter's father is," Kyla said.
After she told Gray her story, she insisted on tending to his arm. The pain was immense, but when she was done cleaning, administering a healing ointment, and bandaging the wound, it felt much better. He cupped her cheek and said, "Thank you," and then went up to the deck. Gray wanted to tell Captain Smithers what a fool he had been, but seeing the way the man continued to stare aimlessly out at sea, he didn't think he needed to tell him something he already knew. Kyla's story was a collection of images in Gray's head, flashing past one by one, repeating over and over. After her mother died, Kyla was forced to go off to sea with her father, who was the lifelong captain of a merchant vessel called the Jewel. Every fortnight they anchored at a new city, loading and unloading the ship, spending a night or two on dry land before sailing once more. At first it was a new adventure, and the best possible way to get past her mother's death, but soon Kyla grew tired of all the travelling, and longed to stay in one place. At a particular stop in Talis, she met a dashing young lad, Callum. They fell for each other quickly and completely, as many young lovers do, and she'd given herself to him in every way. Kyla desperately wanted to stay with him in the city, desperately wanted to marry him. Her father refused, dragging her to the ship, kicking and screaming. A few months later, she was unable to hide her secret any longer. She was with child. Her father demanded to know who the father was, whether it was Callum from Talis. He demanded to have his revenge, threatening to beat the boy within an inch of his life for unflowering his only daughter. Fearing for her true love, Kyla lied. In an outburst of anger, she said she didn't know who the father was, because she'd taken a lover in every city they'd stopped at over the last few months. It could be any one of them, she claimed, so he'd have to beat them all to get his vengeance. She even managed to laugh to sell the lie. In a fit of rage, he banished her to the lower decks, refusing her the sky and the sun and the fresh air, even when they were at port. He encouraged his men to call her the whore child and other names, which Kyla had worn like a badge of honour while protecting her Callum. When they stopped at Talis several times over the next few months, she pretended they were somewhere else, anywhere else. She slept for as many hours as she could, until she felt the ship's anchor being raised and the sails flapping in the wind once more. One day, she hoped to return to Callum with their daughter in her arms. Now, that day would never come. Gray was the only one who helped Kyla prepare to send her daughter into the depths, though the other sailors watched from a distance, as if afraid that whatever killed the babe might be contagious. First, they secured Myrie's cloth wrappings, with a tar-like substance used to mend damage to the ship. Then they constructed a miniature boat out of scrap wood. Although Gray's right arm was strong now, it was still uncoordinated, and after a few failed attempts, Kyla took over the hammering. Once the boat was deemed seaworthy, they lashed the cocooned babe to it with thick ropes, letting the excess dangle at each end. Gray helped as much as he could, but it was Kyla who knew the right kind of knots to tie. When they finished, they both stared at their work for a few moments, unspeaking. The moment their eyes met, they knew it was time. Gray took one side, determined not to drop the little boat, despite only having one arm to lift with. Kyla raised the other end, gritting her teeth. For an instant, the boat wobbled between them, and Gray almost fell, but then another set of hands appeared on the unbalanced side. Captain Smithers nodded to Gray, who nodded back. Tears streamed down Kyla's face as the three of them manhandled the boat to the edge. The captain's strong hands gripped the excess rope, his knuckles whitening as he lowered the boat to the churning waves below. While Gray watched, Kyla hugged her father from behind, all the animosity from the past few months vanishing in that single stolen moment. And then the tiny boat floated, pulled away by a strong current, and Smithers released the ropes, which slapped the water with a splash before sinking out of sight. Side by side by side, the three of them followed the boat's progress with their eyes, until it was naught but a bobbing smudge in the distance, a speck next to the vastness of the great blue sea.
"Goodbye, Myrie," Kyla said,
kissing the tops of her fingers and pointing them toward her lost child. Tears sparkled in her eyes. The men got back to work, silent as they toiled under the hot sun. The Dead Isles appeared a day later in the form of black, jagged cliffs against the horizon. The isles, which were the subject of many a dark and scary campfire story, were barely visible through the fine white mist that surrounded the land, clinging to the rocks like a wet blanket.
"You don't have to leave," the captain said,
sidling up to Gray, who had risen from his daily scrubbing when the lookout had sighted land.
"The Dead Isles are an evil place. You can stay on as a deckhand. You're the best one-armed worker I's ever had on me ship."
Gray smiled grimly. He was fairly certain he was the only one-armed worker the captain had ever hired. "Thank you, but no. My path is elsewhere." Smithers nodded.
"Be careful."
He extended a hand.
"And thank ye for taking care of me little girl when I's too foolish to do so myself."
Gray took his hand, squeezing firmly.
"Your daughter was only with one man," he said, "and I believe he is a good one. Your daughter chose a good one."
"I know," the captain said. He wiped at his eyes. "I knew the whole time, but didn't want to admit it."
"The next time you stop in Talis, permit Kyla to go ashore. Callum is waiting. She'll need his comfort."
The captain nodded again, and then released Gray's hand.
"I'm sorry, but we won't sail closer to the islands, else we might ne'er escape the fog."
"I understand."
Gray climbed into the small boat the captain had generously given him. Two men stepped forward and lifted the sides over the railing, while two others braced their feet and held the ropes. None of them had called him cripple since yesterday. Gray looked back at the captain.
"Say goodbye to Kyla on my behalf."
Last he'd seen her, she was sleeping. She'd been sleeping since they sent her daughter off, and Gray didn't want to wake her. The captain started to say, but his words were lost amidst the sound of pounding footsteps on the deck.
"Gray!"
Kyla shouted, her chest heaving as she reached over the edge of the boat to hug him. Her breath was hot on his neck, her body warm against his. Her curls tickled his cheeks.
"Must you leave?"
"I'm sorry," Gray said. "My sister needs me."
"Shay,"
she said. Gray nodded. "She's all alone. We only have each other now."
"No,"
Kyla said, shaking her head.
"You have us, too. You have me."
Gray touched her face briefly with his one hand, and then said,
"Find Callum. Be happy. I will.
Kyla blinked rapidly.
And thank you. For everything.
Gray said, it was nothing. He really meant it. He'd done nothing but clean up a mess, hold her, and listen to her. He had not been brave, not fought a great warrior, not slayed a dragon. He'd done what a mere child would have been capable of doing. Kyla grabbed his hand and squeezed it fiercely.
No, you're wrong. It was something. It was a great thing. Our greatest moments are often unseen and unheard, but they are never unfelt. My mother told me that once. I felt everything you did.
Gray's first instinct was to continue to let her praise slide off of him. But he knew that wasn't fair to her or himself. He nodded, his eyes as comfortable on her as they'd ever been on anyone, even Rhea. When Kyla felt her father's hand on her shoulder, she finally pulled away. She stretched her arm around him, and he reciprocated. A bond broken, a bond repaired, Gray thought. He wondered whether other kinds of bonds could be fixed, too. He wondered if he could be fixed. As his small boat descended to the sea, his eyes never left Kyla's. He would never forget her, and he knew she would never forget him. He only looked away when the waves lapped at the sides of his craft, churning around him. Though he'd been given two oars, he could only use one at a time. He used one to push off from the boat. He began to paddle toward the mist-shrouded rocks, switching sides every dozen or so strokes so he wouldn't row in circles. Soon, however, he realized he didn't need to paddle. The current pulled him swiftly, straight for the Dead Isles. Something carried him toward the last place in the Four Kingdoms anyone would want to go, and yet it was exactly where he needed to be. 22. The Southern Empire, Calip. Raven Sands. Raven stared into the flames of the unburning tree, seeking answers where there were none. Why did her mother have to die? Why was Raven born without a Tatuya while fire was? Why did she fail in the arena? The unburning tree made no sound, not so much as a crackle, its stoic branches wreathed in fire. Whisper walked gracefully across the courtyard and kneeled down next to Raven, not caring that her white dress sank into the dust. She said nothing, watching the flames writhe and dance. Raven's youngest sister wouldn't be riding with them to war. She was the last daughter, the one who would be responsible for ruling all of Calip if both Fire and Raven perished during the battle. After Whisper, there were only two other Sands still alive, her aunts, Viper and Windy. Windy was currently in Citadel, along the edge of Dragon Bay, studying history. Raven had always known her to be a gentle sort, like Whisper, more likely to sketch a dragon than ride one. A stream had been sent to inform Windy of her sister's death, but no response had been received thus far. Viper was in Zoon, managing the fighting pits. Ever since she challenged Raven's mother in combat for the Empire and lost, she and Sun had been feuding. A message had also been streamed to Viper, but Raven didn't expect her to mourn her sister's death. Finally, Fire emerged from her quarters wearing her red leather armor. A sword dangled from a hip scabbard. The distance melted away and she kneeled between her two sisters, following their gazes to the unburning tree. She spoke.
Marta would have wanted us to be united in whatever comes next, sisters. And we are. We are stronger together. Do you remember when she gave us our names? Of course, Raven remembered.
Sands women were given their names when they were 8, old enough to understand the words of wisdom passed down by their mater. Before that, they were called Royal Child in order of birth. Raven was Ati, Fire was Bati, and Whisper was Kati.
Yes, Whisper said.
She recited her mother's words from memory.
You are the voice in the dark, the hushed silence bearing secrets, the voice of reason in the night. The underestimated daughter, the vision of beauty that glistens like a mirage in the desert, unreachable. You are the tears in the rain, the voice in the wind, the sound in the silence, the child of nature.
You are the third daughter. You are Whisper.
Raven went next. You are the flap of dark wings behind the clouds, the clever thinker in the branches, the misunderstood, the sharp claws and sharper beak. You are the bold hunter, the unexpected warrior, the child of the sky. You are the first daughter. You are Raven.
Fire nodded, and Raven was surprised to see liquid diamonds sparkling in her eyes. She said,
You are the unburning child, the devourer of the weak, the breaker of branches, the licking flames. You are the fierce warrior, the unquenchable torch, the child of war. You are the second daughter. You are fire.
We are the three daughters of the rising sun, Raven said. As one, we cannot be defeated, Whisper said. Not today. Not ever,
Fire finished. The ritual completed, they sank back into silence. Whisper's eyes closed. Fires never seemed to blink, capturing the flames in flickering reflections. Raven stared past the unburning tree, to another time, another place. She loved playing with her father's long, twisted braids. She was always grabbing them and roping them around her arms. He would grab her and twirl her around, and she would scream with delight. Fire would rush to her rescue, sometimes overzealously, her flames creeping down her arms, forcing Fata to dance back, howling at her. Whisper was always the last to join the fray, grabbing Fata's leg and refusing to let go, making him drag her around like a prisoner chained to a metal ball. Her brothers, Fox, Fang, and Falcon, would always just watch, too self-important to get involved.
Oh, Fata,
Raven said aloud.
I miss him,
Whisper said, opening her eyes. Fire shot an annoyed look between them. He is the enemy now. Our brothers, too. We rule with strength. He rules with fear. We will give his people a new life, one worth living. Of course, Raven agreed with her sister on this point. Slavery was wrong, unnatural. One should not control another, not like that. But it didn't change the fond memories she had of him. And the memories didn't change what they needed to do. The Guanic's rough skin undulated beneath Raven. She barely felt its steps, which were so seamless it was almost as if it slithered like a snake, rather than walked on four powerful legs. It was the largest they had and her favorite. She called it simply Ichnon, the big one. Her whips dangled from both of its sides, coiled in perfect circles. The Calypsians lining the sides of the procession didn't make a sound, watching them go with blank-eyed stares. It was no surprise Calypso was known as the Silent City. Even war wouldn't rouse them from their heat-induced stupor. But Raven knew it wasn't lack of passion or sadness that silenced them. No, it was their strength. They were survivors, a people who thrived on duty and honor and victory. And they would emerge victorious, as they always had, for thousands of years, long before the Crimeans arrived in their warships, back when their enemies were the forest dwellers in the east, the barbarians in the north, the nymphs and sprites of the western woods. Raven lifted her chin proudly and faced forward, hundreds of Guanic ridden by the Guanero stomping behind her. Hundreds more marched on foot, bearing sword and shield, whip and club, dagger and spear. They were 3,000 strong, a full quarter of the strength of Calip. The remainder of the army was spread out throughout the southern peninsula, guarding the borders from the constant threat of invasion by their enemies. Fire led the war party from the city, her sword raised high, sheathed in flame. Her arm must be growing weary, Raven thought. But her sister's limb didn't so much as tremble nor falter, not until they'd departed the shadow of the last of the sandstone dwellings. She is so strong, Raven marveled. A little reckless, but strong. Stronger than I. Perhaps it was better that Fire ruled. Perhaps she would be the one to finally end the 12-year-long civil war with their father. Raven didn't look back at Calypso. Couldn't look back, knowing her sister was holding vigil at the apex of the tallest pyramid, Calipa, lighting a new candle every day that passed in her sister's absence.
"I will return," she promised the wind, breathing out and sending her message back to Whisper.
In her mind, she pictured one of the candles blowing out, and her sister smiling in recognition. The first portion of the journey was relatively easy, the dry, dusty landscape flat and firm. The soldiers talked and laughed, their demeanour relaxed. "As it should be," Raven mused. "We have an entire desert between us and battle." The wind was warm, but not as stifling as it could be. Raven pushed back the scarf covering her shaved scalp. She ran a palm across her skin, feeling the roughness of hundreds of new hairs poking up. "Enjoying the ride?" Fire asked, looking back. "I prefer the wind under me," she said. "But yes, we are fortunate that the weather is mild."
"You and your dragons," Fire commented.
Raven's sister had never taken an interest in the dragon brood that had been hatched when they were infants. "Perhaps because you can breathe fire on your own." Raven, on the other hand, had spent countless days with the Dragon Masters, interacting with the young Dragonia, learning their unique personalities, their temperaments, what they liked to eat. Fire didn't understand the dragons the way Raven did. They were like cats, almost human-like in terms of the differences between them. Fire saw them only as weapons of war, powerful beasts that could lay waste to their enemies. Of course, that was true, too. Raven had seen firsthand what they could do during the annual testing. Though the Dragon Masters insisted the dragons were not ready for true battle, already their scales were like triple armor plate, their flames as hot as 1,000 fires, their claws like whetted daggers. "Give them another year," Raven thought. "They will be unstoppable." As usual, the mention of the dragons drove a wedge between the sisters, almost as if they spoke different languages. Silence reigned, and Raven focused on the stripe of deep blue growing larger against the cracked brown terrain. The distance fell away as the sun boiled overhead, eventually simmering toward day's end. Dusk was announced by the crashing of waves. 2 decades ago, the Skara Desert was connected to Calip by a narrow strip of land, wide enough for 100 soldiers to walk abreast of each other. Now the land masses were separated by a flowing waterway, the Canal of the Rising Sun, which allowed Dragon Bay to flow into the Burning Sea and vice versa. If the Skara and the rest of the 4 kingdoms were the body, then Calip was the head, severed by a watery slash through the neck that took 12 years and the efforts of 1,000 slaves to complete, including the enormous bridge that now spanned the gap. According to Raven's Mata, completing the canal had been her father's obsession from the moment they married, and a source of great contention between them, particularly because of his use of Terran slaves for the project. 2 years after the bridge was completed, her parents severed their marriage pact, and civil war erupted in the south. Originally, Vinhosa claimed the main use of the canal was to provide a direct shipping lane from the growing city of Citadel to Fanes, but Sun Sands had soon realized the other true purposes. First, to provide an avenue for Phoenician slave traders to travel to the fighting pits of Zoon to sell their slaves into a life of combat and, most likely, death. Though all of the Sands knew the fighting pits were a necessary evil in order to punish criminals and maintain peace in their land, none but her Aunt Viper loved them. And, second, to offer Hosa another source of slaves, the Dreadnoughts, the large barbarian island that had been conquered by the Calypsians years earlier. However, despite Raven's hatred of what the bridge represented, slavery, she had to admit it was a true marvel. Supported by enormous stone columns, the bridge spanned such a great distance that Raven could barely make out the opposite side, which faded into the thickening evening murk. The bridge rose on a gradual incline until it reached its center, where it once more descended to near sea level. This hill was necessary so that even the tallest ships would be able to pass safely beneath it. Fire stood next to Raven, taking in the wondrous sight. "If Fata can do this with 1,000 slaves, what can he do with an army of 10,000 or 100,000? She asked. "Conquer the world," Raven said. She was beginning to wonder whether her younger sister had been right about attacking now. The longer they gave her father to grow his army, the greater his advantage would be. Except for the dragons, Raven thought. In any case, it didn't matter now. There would be no turning back once they reached the desert. "We'll camp here tonight," Fire said. Eager Guanero passed the message back through the ranks, and soon their own thousands had erected a makeshift camp, sprawling across the dry land. Leaders like the Sand Sisters and the other Guanero slept in tents, while the rest of the soldiers passed the night under a blanket of red, green, and gold stars. The next morning, wind whistled beneath the bridge, hitting it side-on like a slap from the broadside of a sword. Standing beside the sisters, the broad-shouldered Guanero war chief, Goggin, said, "We'll be knocked off like wooden thimbles." It wasn't the comparison Raven would have chosen, but then again, Goggin's Marta was a seamstress. She'd seen the large man darn a sock, and despite his sausage-like fingers, she had to admit his dexterity was impressive. "We'll stick to the middle, three astride, save for the Guanero, who shall ride single file," Fire said. Goggin shook his head.
"Thimbles,"
he muttered again. Raven laughed. "Don't you know how to swim?"
"Aye," he said. "Just like a rock."
Fire said, "Then you can show the rest of us how it's done." Raven knew her sister had never learned to swim either. As a child, she'd been far too focused on lighting things on fire to appreciate the one thing that could be used against her, water. Raven, on the other hand, was an excellent swimmer, having spent summers with her Aunt Windy at Citadel, relishing the taste of the salt of Dragon Bay on her lips, the crystal-clear waters teeming with beautiful multicolored fish nibbling the glowing incandescent reefs. No, she didn't fear the water, but her ability to float would do nothing to save her from a sheer drop that would turn the burning sea into granite. "We should wait until the winds die down," Raven said, surprised to find herself agreeing with Goggin. "No," Fire said. "The weathermasters advised that the Skara is between storms." "I know. I was there. But they gave us a fortnight to reach the spear. At the most. If half the army ends up in the sea, it won't matter how quickly we reach the Southron gates." In the end, Fire went ahead with the plan to cross. Raven was frustrated with her sister's stubbornness and recklessness, but she was the Empress now, and Raven had no choice but to follow her command. But there was something else that worried her more, something in Fire's crimson eyes that she had never seen before. At first she thought it was determination, purpose, but now she wasn't certain. They started across the bridge, following Fire's orders, though many of the foot soldiers ended up traveling single file. The swirling winds pelted them from both sides, forcing them to stagger crookedly as if they'd drunk too much Simpra. Twice Raven was forced to dismount and coax Iknong forward, as the large Guanic refused to take another step, snorting and flicking its tongue. Fire's mount, like her, showed no fear, practically galloping across the bridge, reaching the end far before anyone else. Eventually, however, they made it across, even Goggin, though his face was as white as the sifted sands of Citadel, his eyes wide and wild.
"Within an inch of my life, I swear it," he said as he kissed the sand, his thick lips coming away looking like a powdered pastry.
Behind them, the bridge was an endless train of soldiers, stretching all the way to the opposite shore, where a sizable number had yet to step onto the stone walkway. Fire cursed under her breath. "We'll lose an entire day at this rate." In truth, they lost 2 days, as nearly half the army was forced to wait for sunrise before starting onto the bridge. Led by Goggin, most of the soldiers passed the time fishing and drinking Simpra, preparing a great feast to celebrate their arrival on the edges of the Skara. And feast they did, late into the night, resting their sore feet and telling stories of the shifting sands of the desert, which had apparently swallowed entire platoons of Easterners whole.
"The Skara will allow only the most stalwart of men to cross its flanks," Goggin declared, raising his fist in the air.
He'd already polished off 4 skins of Simpra, Raven knew. She'd been counting. After the second one, he'd removed his shirt and begun pointing to each of his dozens of scars and telling stories of where he got them. He even claimed one, a long thin line across his abdomen, was from a dragon claw, though Raven knew for a fact it had been his ex-wife's attempt to cut him open. After the third drink, he'd removed his pants and started on the scars running up his legs. That's when Fire had shaken her head in disgust and left. Raven had watched her go, wondering why she was acting so broody. Was it just the fact that they'd lost 2 days? For some reason, she didn't think so. Raven stood now, planning to join her sister in sleep. Most of the other soldiers were already asleep, as well as the Guanic, resting their chins on their foreclaws, their deep breaths hissing between 3 rows of teeth. "So only men can cross the Skara," Raven said, a parting shot to Goggin, who was sitting on a thin layer of sand in only his underleathers. She knew Goggin was no sexist, but still she couldn't resist.
"Women are the desert," he slurred. "Hot and endless, and as beautiful as the day is long."
She flung him a tired smile and said, "Get some rest." She expected to find Fire asleep in her tent, but instead she was lying on her back outside of it, staring up at the stars. Without a word, Raven laid down next to her. One of the red stars shot across the sky. "A sign from the gods," Raven said. Fire sighed. "What is it, sister?"
"Nothing. You've been distant. We are all distant from each other. We are like the stars. We can see each other, but only from a distance. Not if you let me see you."
Raven had never been as close to her sister as she'd wanted to be. The rivalry between them had prevented that. But now, Fire's final victory over her had swept that all away. And yet, she felt more apart from her than ever before.
"That's impossible," Fire said.
With a final sigh, she rolled over and crawled into her tent. Raven shook her head, trying to understand what she was missing. Another star rocketed across the dark sky in a blaze of light. The next day they entered the Skara, the hard-packed dust of Calip giving way to thick piles of sand, as hot as lit coals under the blazing eye in the sky. Raven's reptilian steed galloped up the first dune, its powerful legs churning over the thick terrain. Fire waited for her at the top, and they continued astride, racing down the backside before starting up the next hill. Unlike the previous night, her sister seemed in good spirits now that they were on their way again. Fire whooped and flung a fireball at a brittle dark plant known as Morgotha, death leaf, which caused asphyxiation when ingested. "Don't want any of the Guanic munching on that one," Fire explained when she saw Raven's raised eyebrow. Raven shook her head. Her sister knew as well as she that the animals were intelligent enough to avoid a plant that would kill them. She also knew her sister enjoyed playing with her fire far too much. As the sun continued to rise, the day became hotter, the rounded dunes acting as reflectors, sending the hot rays burning in all directions. Raven felt like she was being boiled alive, even when she dipped her shawl in water and covered her bald brown head. After Ichnon clambered up a particularly large hill, she stopped to let the beast rest, offering it some water, which it lapped at with its long, snake-like tongue. Fire was already 3 dunes ahead, her smaller Guanic handling the heat and exertion far better than her own. Behind them, the line of soldiers that had appeared so regal, well-trained and proud in the confines of the city, had been stretched, becoming a ragged, tangled thread. Hundreds had fallen well back, struggling in the heat. Goggin caught up to her, his own Guanic nearly as large as Raven's, and yet still laboring under the man's immense weight and dual steel scimitars, which curled like silver waves on either flank.
"It's as hot as the inside of a clay oven," he said.
"I find it to be quite cool," Raven said. "That breeze, ah!"
The wind whipping over the dunes was so hot she could almost see the air sizzling.
"What does that word mean? Cool?" Goggin joked back.
Raven would have laughed, but her mouth was too dry, her skin too rough with sand, and she was afraid the edges of her lips might crack. They started down the dune, riding side by side.
"Many years have passed since I enjoyed the hospitality of Kesh,"
Goggin said, determined to make conversation. "I've never had the pleasure."
"No, I suppose not. Why should the Empress take her three daughters across the desert?"
"Tell me about the desert city." Kesh was the only major dwelling in the Skara, an oasis in the sand, a place to replenish water skins and rest in the shade for a while. The city had saved many lives over the centuries.
"No,"
Goggin said. "No?"
"You have to experience it for yourself."
He smiled broadly. Reaching the peak of another dune, Raven could barely imagine there being a city out there. The dunes marched endlessly from horizon to horizon, crashing waves of sand, always moving, always shifting, blown by the hot thrust of the wind. Staring out across the desert now, she could almost believe that it had swallowed people whole in the past. Fire was five dunes ahead now. Raven had a feeling that if it was up to her sister, Fire would attack the Southron gates all on her own. "And she'd probably win," she mused. Finally, she allowed herself a laugh, spurring Icon forward until she'd caught up to her sister, the warrior empress. When they camped after the first day in the desert, the mood was weary but upbeat. None had perished, save for one of the smaller Guanic, which was bitten by a large black scorpion. The poison acted quickly, leaving most of the meat uncontaminated. They would not waste the beast's sacrifice, so fires were lit and the meat was cooked, spiced with atmaran and sage and sintar, an aromatic mix of flavors known in Calypso as mixer. Everyone ate merrily, washing the fiery meat down with guzzles from their waterskins. Though it would take them four long, sweltering days to reach Kesh, they had plenty of water, so there was little need to ration. None drank Simpra, not even Goggin, for the strong drink was dehydrating. Afterwards, several soldiers started a song circle, and it didn't surprise Raven to find Goggin at the center of it, bellowing in his deep, gruff voice. Fire watched everything from just outside her tent, idly passing flames between her fingers. Raven plopped down beside her, the sand warm and soft through her leathers. "You rode hard today," she said. Fire flicked her thumb, and the flame bounced, landing back on her palm. "I only know how to ride one way." "Sister," Raven said. Fire didn't look at her, concentrating on making the flame spin in lazy circles. "Sister," she insisted. And when Fire finally met her eyes, she said, "I don't hold your victory over me against you the way Aunt Viper did against Marta. I am with you in this. I hope you know that. You're not alone." Fire chewed on her lip, paused, and then said, "I've been alone since the moment I was born." With that, she snuffed out the flame between her fingers and crawled into her tent. Over the next 2 days, Raven tried to talk to her sister, but Fire grew more and more withdrawn, slipping into long periods of silence, riding far ahead of the rest of the Guanero. Perhaps their mother's death had hit Fire harder than she initially showed. Perhaps she was feeling the weight of responsibility on her shoulders in a way she never expected to. Or perhaps it was just the oppressive heat, which was beating down on all of them. By day three, no one talked when they camped. No one sang, not even Goggin, who rode hunched over, his head lolling on his shoulders. Four more Guanic had died. One was the victim of another black scorpion, two had collapsed from exhaustion, and the last stumbled and broke its leg. The meat was not wasted, but it still seemed a great loss. Two soldiers had also died. One was naught but a boy, 2 years younger than even Fire, who was only 16. He'd gone off to make water, and when he didn't return, was searched for. He was found lying face down with two punctures in his neck. A cobra was discovered nearby, slashed in half by the boy's last act. The other was a grizzled old veteran warrior, who'd simply passed in the night. His end was so peaceful that everyone assumed he was only sleeping in late until someone tried to rouse him. On the morning of the fourth day, Raven joined Fire before they started their march. The young Empress was staring out across the dunes, searching the horizon. "What do you see?"